Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Judge in Florida is deciding another hot-button issue. This time, it's a 13-year-old girl in state custody who wants to have an abortion. Last night, a judge permitted the girl to have the procedure, but the state is appealing, saying Florida law doesn't allow it. Joining us on the line is Carol Marvin Miller. She's covering the story for the Miami Herald. And Carol, tell us, first of all, what is known about this girl?
Very little is known about this girl. She is identified in court papers only as LG. She's 13 years old. She's been in state care for about 5 years, and at some point, the rights of her parents to raise her were terminated. There was a court hearing called the Termination of Parental Rights, and the result was that her parents were deemed unfit to continue raising her. She's been basically in foster care ever since. In the last couple of years, she's been a kind of chronic runaway. About the beginning or mid-January, LG ran away. While she was gone, she became pregnant. She received counseling, and she told her caseworkers that she wished to terminate the pregnancy. There was an appointment made for April 26 for the abortion, but before she could make that appointment, officials with the Department of Children and Families here in Florida filed an emergency petition with the juvenile court judge to halt the abortion. What resulted was a temporary order from Judge Ronald Alvarez in West Palm Beach that the procedure be halted while he take testimony to determine whether LG was competent to make a decision on her own.
Well, we understand that the state, which is trying to prevent the abortion, is citing a state law that says that in no case shall the Department of Children and Families consent to sterilization, abortion, or termination of life support. And they're saying that the DCF has a custodial responsibility to uphold that law.
That is what they're saying. The problem is that the attorneys for LG are citing a Florida Supreme Court decision. That case stands for the proposition that a minor has the right to make a decision herself on whether or not to seek an abortion. There is, however, a fairly new parental notification law, which has not really made its way through the system, and it hasn't been implemented yet. But notification is different from consent. DCF, of course, was notified of her decision to terminate the pregnancy, but the ruling from Judge Alvarez says that they don't have a right to consent or not consent.
Carol, what is expected to happen today?
I don't know what will happen today. Today is likely to be very fluid in terms of the legal activity. Last night, there was a flurry of activity. There was an order from Judge Alvarez allowing the girl to proceed with the abortion, which was immediately followed by an appeal from the department. So the judge's order was stayed, and she could not have her abortion. Her lawyers then asked Judge Alvarez to lift the stay, which he did, and he ordered that DCF transport her to get the procedure done. DCF refused. He then signed an order allowing LG's lawyers to transport her to the clinic. And at that point, DCF appealed the transport order. And that was done so late in the day that LG's attorneys had no opportunity to respond. We expect that there will be more legal activity this morning. And at some point, this will all sort itself out.
And in the meantime, Carol Marvin Miller, there is a 13-year-old girl in Florida who is, just from the sounds of it, packing and unpacking a bag. It seems like this has been further trauma.
I think that's right. When you have a situation such as this, and cases like this occur with some frequency in Florida, it's difficult to remember that what you're talking about is a 13-year-old child, really, a child who is carrying a child. And her attorney told us last night that this ordeal has been very frustrating and very difficult for her to endure. She was extremely disappointed last night. She had been told by her attorneys that they were taking her to have the procedure done, only to find out moments later that that was not going to occur.
Carol Marvin Miller, reporter for the Miami Herald. Carol, thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to talk with you.
And this news has just come in from the Associated Press. Governor Jeb Bush has said that the state of Florida will not appeal further in the case of this 13-year-old girl, clearing the way for her abortion. A Lexington, Massachusetts father spent one night in prison and now awaits a June 1st court appearance on charges of trespassing at his son's elementary school. David Parker refused to leave a meeting he was having with officials from the Joseph Esterbrook Elementary School because, he says, he wasn't getting satisfactory answers about whether or not gay parenting issues would be brought up in his son's kindergarten class. Parker says it all started when his son brought home a bag of books on diversity. One was titled Who's in a Family, and it featured two illustrations of same-sex couples and their children. Well, the superintendent of Lexington Public Schools is William Hurley. Hurley told reporters last week that the book mirrors the real world and has nothing to do with sex.
What we're trying to do as a community in Lexington, and it's not just the schools, but it's something that the culture of this community embraces, is to respect, to understand differences and to respect them. We have a very diverse community here. We want all the children in our school to feel comfortable as children, regardless of what their background is, religious background, their nationality, whatever the gender of their parents happen to be, so that children won't be bullied, or they won't be teased, or they won't be made fun of. That's the goal. It's not force-fed. It's not part of the curriculum that's being taught. It's an opportunity for parents to have this material provided to them. If they choose not to use it, they do have the option of not sharing it with their children. There's an assumption there that it's homosexuality, and that's what it is. The book does not say that. I had cousins who were raised by our two aunts, and they called them mom. There's no reference in the book that these women are engaged in sexual activity or are homosexual or have chosen a gay lifestyle. It just shows two women raising the children. They, as adults, are making the assumption, well, if they're two women, then they're engaged in sexual activity, gay sexual activity. The book doesn't talk about that. It doesn't reference that. And I just gave you an example where that isn't the case.
William Hurley, superintendent of public schools in Lexington, Massachusetts. But parent David Parker is not convinced. He joined an anti-gay marriage group called Article 8 Alliance and vows to fight school policy. He joins us on the line from his home in Lexington, Massachusetts. Welcome, David.
Pleasure to be here.
And I have in front of me the email exchange that preceded the meeting that you had at the school. It's an exchange between you and the school principal.
Mm-hmm.
As you well know, they've been posted by the anti-gay marriage group here in Massachusetts, Article 8 Alliance. In that exchange, the principal seems to tell you that this kind of diversity is not taught in kindergarten classrooms. It's not in the curriculum.
Okay. Well, one would never know that because they refuse to do parental notification of any material, and they refuse the opt-out option. The issue centered on a request to opt out when the material comes up, and a parental notification if it's planned. A lot of people that bring up the diversity book bag really is not seeing the forest for the tree. It's not about the book per se, but that threw up the red flag to delve deeper into the issue than when I found out that much more material was going to come in and there were books in every class, et cetera, I wondered where enough would be enough.
Well, again, the Lexington school system says the issue of same-sex parenting is not in your son's curriculum. They also say they notified parents about the diversity book bag that went home with the kids and that parents could opt not to use it, just put it in the closet and never open it. So could you just explain more about your concern about not being notified? It seems that they're saying there's nothing to notify you about.
The line in the sand was actually drawn when I asked for the opt-out option and parental notification if things were planned. That's what the showdown was about.
What did they say to you when you asked for that?
They said that the law doesn't require us to notify you, and I could not accept that, and I think it's an untenable position.
What they're saying is that by law they are required to notify parents if there are sex education classes,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't put this in that same category. In other words, they're not conflating sexual activity with parenting.
Well, it's interesting. The law actually includes human sexuality, and it amazes me that they look at this law and only talk about sexual education, but very clearly sexual education and human sexuality issues.
The school also says that while they don't have any plans for anything in the curriculum, there's nothing they can do to stop any of the children in the school, and there are children in the school whose parents are gay, from talking about it. So they can't make you a promise that your children might not hear about it on the playground. Isn't that a valid tough spot for the school?
Well, I never said that those conversations should be blocked or even told to me. What I was concerned of is when an adult was involved in mediating those discussions or furthering them or in any way coloring them, that's where I have a problem, because adults in the school system, particularly for very young children, are revered authority figures. When children do it, that's something different.
What was your initial reaction when you took out the book from your son's book bag?
My initial reaction was, the book bag was given to him, and there was not what we consider an active or proactive notification. I do concede that they, and believe them, that they had books on one meeting that my wife did attend. But, you know, it's a big school, and we're new here, and she just never saw the books. They sent notification home, but it didn't explicitly talk about things that adults may consider adult themes. So the reaction was, when we got it and my son came in and opened it up as if it were, you know, they might as well give him a gift, and he was ready to dig in there, and he said, this is great. And my wife looked in it before him just to see what this was. Mm-hmm. And she got the book, paged through it, and basically it had the same-sex households with children and a lot of other family constructs.
Well, there are, let's stay with the same-sex ones. That's your biggest concern. There are actually just two illustrations, mm-hmm. one with a female couple and their two children bathing the family dog, and the second, two men preparing dinner with their child and a cat.
Well, I forget the exact depiction, but I'm going to trust you on that one.
and your reaction to seeing that?
I was a little offended that it basically made it through my threshold, and I would not have given it authority. This is really bigger than the Versity book bag. This has been a tactic that will not be successful. This is an issue of parental authority versus school administration authority over a child. And that particular child that we're focusing on in this issue is my child. So the question here is, who has the right to define the terminology? Who has the right to define adult themes? Who has the right to define human sexuality issues? For my child, I have the right to define it, and they must respect that.
David Parker, a parent from Lexington, Massachusetts, who was arrested when he refused to leave a three-hour meeting at his son's elementary school because he felt he wasn't getting satisfactory answers on this topic. When we come back, we'll have more with David, and we'll also meet the author of the book that started the whole controversy. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. Conversation with David Parker, the father who's upset that his son was sent home from kindergarten with an optional book about diversity that featured same-sex parents. And David, as you know, your son's Lexington, Massachusetts elementary school says the issues are going to come up anyway, and they want to protect all kids, including those with same-sex parents. But putting school policy aside, let's say your son comes home and says, Dad, my friend Brian has two dads or two moms.
Mm-hmm.
How would you handle that?
First, I'd say, well, how do you know that, and how what would be the answer?
They told me about it on the playground. We were on the swings, and they talked about their dads. Or I saw their two moms come and pick them up.
Then that is a case where my child is perceiving that there are two mothers. There's plenty of women that love each other, that stand together and do things together, that aren't same-sex marriage or same gay-headed household. When my child comes to me with that realization, then he has determined the timing, and the timing is between him and I. And he needs to be told that this is a reality, that we don't believe that this is right, and in fact, we believe it's a sin, but we're all sinners, and I usually say, welcome to the human race.
So, David Parker, you've spent a night in jail. You have a court case coming up.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you plan to do? I mean, how far do you plan to take this?
What has happened is that Joni J., the principal, and Hurley, at their discretion, have now blocked me from setting foot on any Lexington public school ground. So now when my own child goes into the elementary school, I am barred from entering to pick him up, to drop him off, even in emergency situations. Now, I would call on them and demand that they drop that, at least for access to my child during those hours which my child was in.
That's parent David Parker. And again, the schools in Lexington say he did not leave the school when he was asked. Well, joining us now on the line from California, author Robert Scutch. His book, Who's in a Family, is what sparked all of this controversy in Lexington. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And by the way, what's your response to this? This much controversy?
Well, nothing surprises me when it comes to the subject. I mean, the whole purpose of the book was to get the subject out into the minds and the awareness of children before they are old enough to have been convinced there's another way of looking at life.
Have you had this kind of reaction before?
No, actually, I have not had this reaction before. I've had just the opposite reaction. I have read this book in schools here and to kindergarten and first grade classes, and the reaction of the schools here and the children and the parents has been very positive.
Well, I've got some of the illustrations in front of me, including some of the text. One line says, Laura and Kyle live with their two moms, Joyce and Emily, and a poodle named Daisy. It takes all four of them to give Daisy her bath. And you see Daisy, the dog, being given a bath. Can you understand how somebody for whom this is blasphemy would object to it being in a book that their child brings home from school?
I can understand that people are afraid of the new matters in the world. Plenty of people who are afraid of giving up slavery, too. But the fact of the matter is, this is the way the world is. And it would be really nice if children were not subjected to the, I don't want to use the word bigotry, but that's what I want to say anyway, of their parents and older people. Children are not born bigoted, and children are not born fearful. As it said in the song in South Pacific, you got to be carefully taught.
Even as I hear you speak and your sincerity, I am imagining that David Parker would be very insulted to be called a bigot. You know, he feels this is part of his religious values. But more than that, he feels it's something that it should be taught to his child on his timetable. Parents have lost control of the timetable because kids are talking to each other about their same-sex parents. What's your experience of kids sharing their views about their parents?
Well, I don't have any children that age at this point in my life. But the book was written basically because my niece, my brother's daughter, and her partner decided they want to have a family. I was involved with, you know, seeing them when they were very, very little, this little boy. And he was about two, and he was very cute. And it occurred to me, you know, it's a shame that he's going to go to school and that he's going to be made fun of because he's got two mothers. And I thought, that isn't right. And that's what inspired the book. And that's only one little part of the book. The book is about all kinds of families. It's about interracial families, and it's about animal families and everything else.
So Robert Scutch, do you have children of your own?
Yeah, but they're not...
they're grown,
school,
right.
They're not school children
right.
now.
But when they were, I'm just wondering, how would you have felt if a book came home in a book bag and you opened it and you saw, you know, something that you hadn't yet talked to your kids about in the book?
Well, I personally, you know, I'm very, very open-minded, so I'm not sure that I'm a typical person who you want to ask about that. But, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, people are people, and you know, I have written other things too, which speak to the same subject. Not talking about gay marriage or anything like that, but talking about how hate is born, or how discrimination is born, or how bias is born, or whatever it is you want to call it. If bigotry is too strong, I apologize to Mr. Parker and say whatever word he wants to use. But you know, this is something that the world needs to get over. And the only way it can get over it is to start before they are taught there's another way.
Robert Scutch, author of Who's in a Family, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us to proudly pronounce your name and the town you're from. And tomorrow on Here and Now, Judy Wicks, owner of Philadelphia's White Dog Cafe, puts her money where her morals are, helping pig farmers raise animals humanely. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Bush's tax reform panel wraps up the first part of its work this month. Members have been holding hearings around the country since February, hearing testimony about the tax code. The panel has already announced that it's found too many deductions and credits for taxpayers and that the system needs to be changed. Final recommendations due out next month. Jep Kupfer is the executive director of the President's Advisory Panel on Federal Tax Reform. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes about the panel's work.
Jeff, let me ask you, first of all, what's the overall message, if there is an overall message, that the committee heard as it traveled around the country taking testimony from folks?
Well, I think that the one thing that we've heard from everyone, whether it's on the business side or on the individual side, is just how completely complex our tax system is today and what a burden it is on everyone to comply with it. We have heard testimony that the tax system cost the economy, U.S. economy, about $140 billion per year. And just to put that amount in perspective, that's roughly the same as $1,000 for every family in America. And so what we've heard is that the complexity permeates all aspects of the tax code. And for individuals, it means that they have trouble filling out their returns, understanding the amount of taxes that they need to pay, understanding all the deductions and credits that are in the tax code. And for businesses, it means that they have to spend their resources trying to comply with the tax code and that they can't use them for more productive things like hiring new workers or investing in new technologies.
Are there too many credits and deductions available to taxpayers? That seems to be the initial finding that has come out from the committee.
The way that I would phrase that is that there are a huge number of credit and deductions that are available. Credits and deductions in and of themselves are not bad things. Many of them are for activities that all of us think are good activities. The problem that we have found as we talk about all those different credits and exemptions is that they're difficult for people to understand, very complex. And what it means is that many people don't take advantage of some of the credits and deductions that they should. In the education area, for instance, there's a variety of education provisions, and we've heard testimony that for many people they're so confusing that while those incentives are nice and that they're there, that people are paralyzed by the complexity and they're not able to take them.
On the other hand, saying that you're taking a very close look at the complexity of deductions and credits and whether there are simply too many of them is going to alarm people who feel they pay too much in taxes already.
Right. And what I would say to people is that we are not trying to raise taxes on any particular group of taxpayers. We are keenly aware that many Americans feel that their tax burden as it is too high and that they have no interest or, in many cases, ability to pay higher taxes. What we want to do is take a look at the effectiveness of all those deductions and to determine whether a lower marginal tax rate, a lower tax rate on everyone else, makes sense to impose as a trade-off for some of those deductions or some of those credits. You know, every time that there's a deduction or a credit for a specific activity or a specific type of behavior, it means that everyone else who doesn't get that pays a higher rate of tax. And so that's just an overall trade-off that the panel will look at.
I want you to respond to the concerns of some of the panel's critics who are concerned that the Bush administration has sort of hemmed the panel in a bit and maybe predetermined what it recommends by suggesting that the panel needs to leave President Bush's existing tax cuts in place. It needs to eliminate the estate tax, eliminate some or all of the taxes on investment income, and creating those requirements puts the panel in a box, so to speak, in relation to what it can suggest.
What the president has told the panel to do is to have a revenue-neutral tax reform. In other words, the reforms that we recommend should not raise the overall amount of revenue that the government is taking from the American public, nor should we lower it. So we should stay at the same level. In thinking through what that overall amount of revenue is that we need to stay within, the president has said that the tax cuts should be made permanent. In other words, the money from those tax cuts is what we say in Washington, it's part of the baseline that we're going to follow. The tax cuts over the last few years have been, many would say, responsible for keeping the economy on the path to growth that it's been on, to keep take our economy out of recession and to keep the economy expanding. And so the panel is not in a position to recommend that we reverse those tax cuts and that we begin taking that we increase taxes on people and that we begin taking in more revenue. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's a box that we're in. I would say that within that overall amount of revenue, the panel will come up with different options for reform.
Jeff Kupfer, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Jeff Kupfer is the executive director of the President's Advisory Panel on Federal Tax Reform. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. And this note, a new study contends that parents treat good-looking children better than those who aren't. Researchers at the University of Alberta observed 400 parents while they were shopping at 14 different grocery stores, and the researchers found that what they called ugly kids got less attention and were less likely to be buckled into their carts than their more attractive peers. They also found that unattractive children were more frequently allowed to take part in potentially dangerous activities such as standing up in the carts. Dr. Andy Harrell is the lead author of the study. He says the research shows important evolutionary trends.
The things that have evolved through the course of our evolution, including caretaking behaviors and parenting behaviors, play a very important role in very mundane things. While all the child care literature, the Dr. Spock stuff out there may try to create perfect parents for those who read this material, nevertheless, there are things that have evolved over generations of human beings that play an important role in our care of children.
Dr. Franz Duval, a psychology professor at Emory University, says the study needs to be more comprehensive.
The ideal is, of course, to have the same parents attend to two kind of kids, ugly kids and cute kids, so to speak. But that's not what they did. Each parent had only one kid to attend to, because you would want to know if these kids look good, because they're taken care of so well. In addition, the reasoning behind the study is a bit strange, because they reason that parents should be investing more in beautiful kids than in ugly kids, because beautiful kids will go on reproducing and so on. Well, ugly kids reproduce, otherwise we wouldn't have any ugly people in the world. So there's ugly people do reproduce quite a bit, and I'm not sure that there's any difference in that regard with beautiful people. And so the whole premise on which the study is based seems weak to me.
Well, Dr. Harrell says more research is needed to fully determine the evolutionary impact of a child's looks. Meanwhile, this editorial comment, we were not aware that there was such a thing as an unattractive child. You're listening to Here and Now. A Buffalo, New York firefighter who spent the last 10 years blind and silent in a rehabilitation home suddenly spoke last weekend and asked for news of his family. Donald Herbert was critically injured in 1995 when he entered a burning building to search for victims. The roof collapsed on him, and trapped under the debris and deprived of oxygen, he suffered severe brain damage. After 2.5 months in a coma, he settled into a waking but unconscious state from which doctors said he would never recover. Well, already comparisons have been drawn with the Terri Schiavo case, and aunt of Terri Schiavo told a Buffalo TV station that this surprise recovery proved that Schiavo's parents were right to hold out hope. But a spokesperson for the facility where Herbert lives says the two cases are completely different. Joining us on the line is Tom Burton. He's former counsel to the family. And Tom, we understand you represented the Herbert family after the firefighter's accident. So tell us, what was life like for him in the rehabilitation home?
You know, sadly, for someone that was physical, was active, was in a rough and tumble engine house, all of that had been stripped away. He couldn't speak. Functionally blind, he couldn't get up, he couldn't swallow, and most importantly, he couldn't communicate in any fashion, and that all changed dramatically this weekend.
Well, now, when you say in any fashion, did his eyes blink? Did he, was he wasn't in the vegetative state, for instance, that we saw Terri Schiavo in, was he?
Different outward manifestations than what we all saw on TV with the Schiavo case, but the doctors had pretty much indicated that there was no substantive cognition going on. Of course, that was the case right pretty much from when they extracted Donnie from the house when the roof collapsed.
Right after, before he went into the coma. Well, then on Saturday, do we understand that he literally said, "I want to speak to my wife"?
In words and in substance, he was kind of gazing out a window and out of the blue made that representation to the astonishment of his family.
We understand, too, he has 4 children, all boys, and the last one was, about 2. And when the boy answered the phone, when the nurse called home, and he couldn't believe that there was a 13-year-old there.
Well, one of them, had gone on to college. I mean, it was some of that stuff is privilege, but he literally heard 2 people talking in a room, and he recognized who somebody was that was talking. Mm-hmm. And after he got done with the family stuff, the first thing is how are the guys in my crew.
Yeah. What did he say, though, about hearing about his sons?
Oh, I mean, thrilled beyond measure.
And since then, we hear it's probably the biggest reunion Buffalo's ever had, parade of people to his bedside?
It went on for hours and hours, and, during the course of that process, there were firemen that he had mentioned, and, of course, the moment he mentioned that, the boys in blue showed up in droves.
Yeah. But has he said what was happening for him in the past 10 years? Was he conscious of time passing? Was he conscious of people speaking to him?
Well, I wasn't there for all of it, but I'm led to believe that he had perceived he had only been out for about 3 months, Robin.
Yeah. Well, now I understand that the family and the rehab center are not speaking to the press until they figure out what exactly has happened. But in the meantime, we understand, a lot of people are calling this a miracle.
I don't know what to call it, but I can tell you, compared to this poor man's state and what it is now, it's pretty tough to call it anything else.
Well, we understand, finally, that this story involves you personally in many ways. You were in an accident yourself, a spinal cord injury. You were in a wheelchair. Long before Donnie Herbert, the firefighter, had his accident, his family raised money to keep your law offices going, and then you, in a twist, ended up representing his family after his accident.
That's true. And the difference was I had all my cognitive marbles together. Donnie didn't have that privilege. It was easier for me.
Well, that's admirable of you. And some would say now he's got his marbles back.
Well, let's see. This may be the first step in a long journey, and let's just hope it's one that continues.
Tom Burton, a lawyer in Buffalo, New York, speaking about firefighter Donald Herbert, who, after 10 years of silence, spoke this past weekend. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Tony Kushner dedicated his monumental play Angels in America to Oscar Eustace. Oscar who, you might be saying? Oscar with a K, Eustace, and remember that name. It's well known in Providence, Rhode Island, where he's been the artistic director of the Trinity Repertory Company for 10 years. But now, Oscar Eustace is leaving to become the new artistic director of the Public Theater in Manhattan, a place where new playwrights and new directors cut their teeth and actors chew the scenery. And many are hoping that Oscar's move to Manhattan will bring back the vision of the Public Theater's founder, the late Joseph Papp. Oscar joins us from the studios of WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, and I guess I should say congratulations.
Thank you very much, Robin. I appreciate it.
How are you feeling about this move?
I'm a little dizzy, but extremely excited. This is the job I've wanted since I was a teenager, and I never thought I'd actually get it, but here it is, and I feel very lucky.
Well, why is that, by the way? What is it about the Public Theater?
The Public is, I think, the most important theater in the United States. It's Joe Papp founded it 50 years ago by doing free Shakespeare in the Park. And that idea, the idea that culture belongs to the people, that culture is not something that is far away, but something that's here and now, something that's present, is an incredibly powerful idea. And he continued that and developed it by coupling free Shakespeare in the Park with the newest, most cutting-edge work by contemporary American writers at the Public's indoor home at 425 Lafayette in the Lower East Side. Mm-hmm. And that's a model of what the theater is supposed to be.
Well, in fact, you mentioned that this is the job you wanted since you were a teenager. Let's learn a little bit about you, because you weren't a teenager very long, at least in the way we traditionally judge it. Do I understand you graduated from high school at 15?
That's correct, I'm afraid.
Went to New York, and then by 20 you were on your way to Zurich, Switzerland, where you helped run a theater there.
Yeah.
And then out to California.
Yeah.
And your involvement with Tony Kushner is one that people are going to mention, because you were the one who not only staged Angels in America, but commissioned it?
Yeah. Yeah, Tony and I have known each other about 20 years, and I'm happy to say that when I first saw a reading of one of Tony's plays, I knew that this was a major American playwright. So the smartest thing I ever did in my life was recognize that somebody was smarter than me, and that was Tony.
Well, in fact, we have a clip of another play that you worked with him on. It was a relationship that extended to Homebody Kabul. Let's listen to a little of the staging at Trinity Rep.
The private is gone. All must be touched. All touch corrupts. All must be corrupted. And if you're thinking how awful these sentiments are, you are perfectly correct. These are awful times. But you must remember as well that this has always been the chiefest characteristic of the present. The present is always an awful place to be.
Oscar Eustace, public theater in particular is a place where new playwrights get their start. How do you know a Tony Kushner is going to be a Tony Kushner?
Well, there's certain things that you look for, and Tony, of course, is a huge and monumental example, but still he clarifies certain things. Tony's lyric voice, his gift for language and metaphor, is something that really literally, Robin, can't be taught. A writer either has that or doesn't, and Tony had that from the beginning. His ambition and what he wanted to write about, his conviction that the theater was a place where you wrote about the broadest issues of society through the prism of individual experience, is an ambition that I think is quintessentially a public theater ambition. So we're not just looking for great writers. We're looking for great writers who share a belief in the civic power of the theater. And if you've got the voice, if you've got the ambition, then the job of the playwright, or the job of the person who's trying to work with the playwright, is to try and help them develop that voice as fully as they possibly can.
Someone who heads up a theater wears a lot of hats, occasionally director, most of the time bringing in money, clearing the path for a new play. As we said, you commissioned and then staged Angels in America, but didn't take it when it went to Broadway. You weren't the director on Broadway.
No.
Why's that?
There's a lot of reasons, and it's a complicated history, but what it boiled down to is Tony and I had worked very closely for 6 years on the project. It took 6 years for it to develop, and the skills and the relationship that was necessary to develop the play to the point of its completion were not the same as those that were necessary to take it to Broadway. So I'm happy to say that it was taken to Broadway by George Wolfe, who has been my immediate predecessor at the Public Theater. And so I handed off Angels to George, and George is handing off the public to me, and I couldn't be prouder than to be associated with George, because he's also done a spectacular job at the Public.
I guess one of the other things I'm asking is, they really are two different animals, aren't they, Broadway and Public Theater?
No question. The Public is and has long been the icon and model of what a nonprofit theater is supposed to be. At the same time, it has a track record of moving shows to Broadway and commercial success, most spectacularly the production of Chorus Line, which ran for 18 years on Broadway, was a Public Theater production. So clearly we have commerce with Mammon. But at the same time, it's a theater whose ideals are rooted in a nonprofit mentality, and I think that's terribly important.
We want to hear a little more of the sounds that came from Trinity Rep under your reign, if you will. I understand there was one production in particular. It sounds pretty cumbersome, but critics loved it. Cider House Rules.
We did a wonderful two-evening adaptation of John Irving's novel. Peter Parnell, a very gifted playwright, did the adaptation. And it was one of the favorite things that I ever did here, because the combination of self-consciously Dickensian storytelling, a big, socially involved but open-hearted sweep to the novel was, I think, translated beautifully in the theater.
Was this before the film was made?
Yes, it was.
Aside from avoiding any situation of extreme stress or extreme exertion, I want you to know that you can almost certainly lead a normal life.
A normal life? I am an orphan with a heart condition, and you are telling me I can lead a normal life? I am in love with my best and only friend's girlfriend, but you tell me to try to avoid extreme stress?
The little details of Public Theater are, we understand, really important to you. I'm thinking back to when Music Man was being performed. You wanted to have local marching bands take part.
Absolutely. And we did. We managed to get a marching band from almost every community in the state. And it was terribly important to me because Music Man is about the power of art and the power of art in community and what an investment in art and investment in young people can bring to a community. And I like to think that that production is in certain ways a bellwether for the Providence Renaissance, because this is a city that really has invested in its artists and is trying to invest in its young people. And I think many, many good things have resulted from that.
So now you're on to New York, where, I mean, just hearing Public Theater, I'm thinking I can see Kevin Kline doing something. I can see Meryl Streep in the park, you know, these wonderful stars who come down to these productions. And you are, you know, you're handling a very precious baby to many New Yorkers. Are you nervous?
Of course. I'd be crazy if I wasn't nervous. At the same time, Robin, honestly, my whole life has really been preparing for this job. So it's been very interesting stepping into it because, of course, I'm intimidated. Of course, I'm nervous. Of course, I'm anxious about how it's going to go. But every step along the way, as I've been doing the job, what the feeling I have is this is challenging, this is exciting, and I know how to do this. This is something, and the reason I know how to do it is I spent 30 years getting ready to do it. I feel like, actually, I'm the right guy for this job.
That's a nice feeling.
Yeah, it is. It is. I hope I keep it.
Oscar Eustace, the new artistic director of the Public Theater in Manhattan, he leaves his post at the Trinity Repertory Company in Providence, Rhode Island, for good in June. Oscar, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin. I appreciate it.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us now.